Well, I think that a lot of people get into the industry of real estate because of the ability to take a week off or a month off and go to Mexico. And I did too. And I still am in it too. But you'll find that those that are successful, they're not in Mexico. They're not taking time off. They're grinding. It's just important to kind of realize that if you are in this industry because it's an easy way out, it's not the right industry. You have to be an expert. You're competing against Carl Icahn and Warren Buffett and all these guys that there's a reason it attracts them. It's because it's very lucrative.
Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings, the number one show about growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. Now, here's your host, Mark Allen Kenny.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to How to Buy Giant Apartment Buildings. I'm Mark Allen Kenny. Our guest today is Hunter Thompson. How are you doing today, Hunter?
Hey, thanks for having me. Much appreciated.
Hunter is the managing principal of ASIM Capital. ASIM Capital assists investors seeking passive cash flow and is focused on favorable risk-adjusted real estate investments across multiple asset classes and geographical locations. Hunter has raised more than $30 million. He is the author of Raising Capital for Real Estate and host of the Cashflow Connections podcast. Hunter, thank you so much for being here today. I really appreciate it. Could you tell the listeners just a little bit more about your background and how you got started in real estate?
Sure. So I basically have many strengths and, sorry, I should say it the other way, very many weaknesses and just a few strengths. And I think that's the case with pretty much everyone. I'm a big proponent of focusing on your strengths. And that kind of opens up the opportunity for you to have a good life and also enjoy what you're doing, but also leverage other people's strengths as well. And so one of my very few strengths is my willingness to go right when everyone else is looking left. And that can be very advantageous and sometimes lucrative as an investor. So one of the ways this was very pronounced is in the heart of the recession, which I was very much insulated from in 2008. I was still finishing up college at the time. I was very much inclined to focus on financial markets because I could see that there was blood in the streets. And so that was really my foray and entrance into that sector, which was realizing that there was a historically significant correction going on, doing as much as I could to study Warren Buffett, Charlie Munger, read as much as I could about these topics from value investing to algorithmic trading, et cetera, and started doing what those people kind of suggested and picking investments that I thought were going to succeed over the long term. I had success, as most people did, that started in 2008, but it really wasn't until something that happened in 2010, which was kind of my last straw moment with that sector, which is the European debt crisis. And it's something I've talked a lot about before when I speak publicly, but in short, it was very similar to what happened in the United States in Europe. Central banks froze up. There was massive government bailouts. There was massive uncertainty in the markets. And despite the fact that I wasn't investing in European stocks, my United States Dow Jones S&P 500 stocks were taking massive multi-hundred basis point swings in the middle of the day. And I basically realized, despite all this research I had done, despite how many thousands of hours I had spent trying to understand this topic, I was not able to truly identify, mitigate, or eliminate any of these risks that were completely unrelated to my investment thesis. And so I went on a journey to try to figure out how can a small firm, a small family office, an individual person, invest in asymmetric investments that produce lucrative and predictable cash flow. And that quickly led me to real estate.
Awesome. How did you decide on the asset class and deal size once you realized that you wanted to pivot and get into real estate?
So I was very fortunate because I moved to California during the heart of this correction. And so what that did for me was two things. Number one, the market in California was very depressed, but I didn't end up investing in California. So the market valuations were low, of course. But what was probably more interesting was that the market had been so decimated in California that the people that were attending real estate related events were those who were able to weather the storm. And so my investment thesis was crafted out of those extremely sophisticated investors that had, to one degree or another, figured out a way to invest in recession-resistant real estate. was the only thing that was able to overcome that massive, massive ahistoric challenge. And so I was, the first investments I made were investments in $15 to $50 million apartments, self-storage, mobile home parks, et cetera, where you could actually rely on someone else's expertise for the implementation of the business plan, which has come to known very popularly now as the syndicated model. Back then in 2010 or so, that term was not really talked about much outside of ultra high net worth areas. So I was very fortunate to get into that part of the sector, not going through the fix and flip stuff that a lot of my competitors may have done.
Sure, sure. And when you started, were you investing your own capital, or were you raising and helping to place other people's capital, or what did that look like?
Yeah, so I have a background as a poker player. And so the first money that I invested in real estate was money from proceeds of that poker. And when I say background as a poker player, I mean, I did it professionally for about 1 year, specifically one particular summer. That was the first, you know, $25,000 I invested. And once I started to develop a Rolodex of high quality institutional partners and a track record with those institutional partners, I started to invest friends and family capital and then started raising my own money. And, you know, we went from five investors to 10. So now we've got hundreds and have purchased around $100 million worth of commercial real estate. So, you know, very fortunate in the sense that, yes, I started out with my own principal, but once you have a good thing going, you're interested in helping people you love. You know, I wanted to help my mom, I wanted to help my sisters, et cetera. And that was really how ASM Capital got formed.
Yeah, that's fascinating. So I think I heard that you're in multiple asset classes now, like mobile home parks, retail, and things like that. Has your strategy changed much since you originally got started?
In some ways, yes. In other ways, no. So part of why I started that story with the Great Recession is that that was a very foundational and pivotal moment for a lot of investors. For me, it was very clear. If I can create investment opportunities or invest in investment opportunities that are going to perform during significant corrections, and I'm going to give up a little bit of upside, but not a tremendous amount of upside when the economy is doing quite well, I'm going to pursue recession-resistant real estate consistently throughout the cycle. So, you know, to put some points on it, we will always give up the potential lucrative returns that are available in the hotel business, for example. But when the market turns around, hotels can be distressed. And so when this recent crisis with COVID started, I anticipated, you know, from an intuition standpoint, there's going to be a tremendous amount of opportunity in all these asset classes that I love. Now, it hasn't really happened yet, which kind of proves the thesis that we've been focusing on for the last 10 years is in many ways correct. It would actually be not good news if all of a sudden there was a bunch of distressed mobile home parks. We don't find that though. You know, if you can find investment asset classes where the demand is inversely correlated with the overall economy, it really smooths out your whole portfolio, because when the economy is doing well, you're able to raise rents more aggressively, collections are higher. When the economy is doing poorly, more people are in lower incomes, more people are looking for affordable housing. The same is true with senior living and, or not senior living, self-storage as well. Senior living, though it's not inversely correlated with the economy, senior living is basically an inelastic demand. It's very challenging to make that decision in the first place to put someone in a facility like that. So we find that, you know, historically speaking, they're not as cyclical.
Sure, sure. Yeah, that's one thing that really sticks out to me as far as your strategy. It seems like you're more interested in mitigating risk, preserving capital, than maybe participating in the upside, where a lot of, I would say the most popular approach, especially with the people I interview on the show, is, you know, heavy value add, chasing yields, really trying to push that IRR and taking more risks. What are your thoughts on those two different strategies?
Yeah, sure. So, I mean, the name of my company is ASM Capital. For those that are just listening, I have a shirt on that says the name right there. And it's short for asymmetric. So I'm trying to find risk-adjusted favorable returns for our investor base. And I think that, you know, doing it very simple back in the napkin math, as far as why we don't invest in development, for example, I think that it would be challenging to make the argument that development does not have twice the amount of risk as a typical value add type of multifamily deal does. But you likely would not get twice the amount of a return. I mean, it's very hard to underwrite in such a way where, okay, this multifamily deal is going to get a 12 IRR. Well, a development deal down the street, you know, in the same market with the same dynamic, with the same tenant base, it's almost impossible to generate a 24% IRR on a development deal. It's done and it can happen with favorable market dynamics, but you wouldn't want to underwrite that. And underwriting a 12% IRR in today's climate is perfectly reasonable, you know, if you can find a good deal. So I don't have to go much further than that, right? And it's true on both ends of the spectrum. You know, if I can reliably, within a sensitivity analysis of, you know, a couple of standard deviations, generate a low to mid-teens IRR, then I'm going to do that all the time and not expose myself to unnecessary risk in pursuit of getting 30% more of an IRR.
Yeah, that makes sense. And can you speak to that a little bit more? I think a minute ago you said you have a tendency to go right when everyone else goes left. Does that look different today than it did in 2008? Has your strategy changed? And are you finding opportunities where others aren't today, but maybe what you were doing in 2008 isn't possible just because so many other people are trying the same thing? I feel like a lot of capital, because there's so much risk in the markets and the economy right now, I feel like there's a lot of money moving into multifamily. So I'm curious if that's changed your strategy.
Sure. So two kind of points to that. Number one, this industry of private equity real estate has been revolutionized over the last 10 years, particularly with the Jobs Act of 2012, which allowed people to publicly solicit investors in these types of private syndications, private placements. But that has created a bunch of insular circles where we've seen a lot of podcasts pop up. We've seen a lot of people talking about the wealth they've created for their family with multifamily. But the reality is the bond market for negative bonds is $17 trillion. There is not an overwhelming glut of excellent value add multifamily deals. There's an overwhelming glut of capital searching for yield. So it's just important to recognize that. I'm super excited about the change that we've seen in the world of syndications, but that's still wildly out of line where there's money managers that say, wow, we can only lose 1% a year on a Japanese bond. Sounds great. So we've got a lot of work to do. As far as the changing of the strategy, going left when everyone's looking right, if you go back and listen to some of our podcasts going back, starting particularly in 2018, I made a lot of really bullish comments on retail. And the comments were basically because I felt like there was a significant delta between the actual data regarding rent collections of a pretty significant piece of the retail tenant base and the hysteria in the media about the retail apocalypse. So for 2 years, I did incredible volume of underwriting deals, underwriting sponsors, talks, you know, hundreds of hours looking at different deals. I couldn't fight the exact right one that met up with all of my underwriting conditions and also the right tenant base and rent roll and the length of the leases and all the various things that go into retail. And so I never pulled the trigger. But if you go back and listen to it, you can tell that that's hopefully my evolution as an investor is seeing that there's this big opportunity to go left when everyone's looking right. But you have to look before you go still. Right. So just because someone says, oh my gosh, retail's in a bubble, that doesn't mean you go the other direction. You have to look and see what's actually going on in the data. So again, to be transparent, a lot of that was luck. You know, my big picture thesis was look at the rent roll, look at the rent roll, look at the rent roll. And it doesn't matter if you looked at the rent roll with COVID. There are top tier, you know, triple A class tenants that said, hey, we're Ross. Or hey, we're CVS. If we don't have anyone coming in our store, we can't pay rent. And that's trickled down. So there's going to be some distress in retail. And I'm very fortunate that, you know, I didn't allocate a lot of capital or investor capital towards that. But my overwhelming point during not only those years, but other years as well, is that diversification is key. That's why I love our strategy so much. It allows us to intelligently participate in the sector through all stages of the cycle, but also with evolving market dynamics. Now, the actual retail apocalypse is happening. And so what are we doing? We're waiting. It's a big question mark. There's so much uncertainty in the space. If you take NOI of a current retail deal and multiply it by 20, you may get a cap rate, but the cap rate is based on income, which is uncertain. So the valuation needs to change. And we don't know what a good discount would be, but we just know there needs to be one. So we're eager and interested, and I think with the right rent roll, there probably will be an opportunity in retail to purchase some distressed assets in the future.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. Are you waiting on other asset classes as well, or are you actively looking and making offers on multifamily and other assets?
So there's two that I think are going to be very interesting coming out of this, which is senior living and distressed debt. Senior living is interesting because there is such a massive tailwind in that industry. The demographic shifts, which I'm sure that a lot of your listeners are familiar with, are just extremely compelling. It's only heading one direction. I think that there's going to be an opportunity for some potential there because there's such a compelling thesis about the demographic shift, but people sometimes don't realize that that shift is a little bit later than most people think. So 10,000 baby boomers hitting the age of retirement every single year. That age of retirement is 65. Typically, people are entering senior living at 77, 82, et cetera. So I'm thinking over the next 5 years, that's going to start to become really compelling. The distressed debt space, also very interesting, in part because of the uncertainty. We've seen a recent and historic spike in defaults and delinquencies, I should say more accurately. And that's going to create a buying opportunity for those in the distressed debt space. In a moment, I know we're going to talk about one of my worst deals, which I did do a distressed deal and learn some really expensive lessons that I'd be eager to talk about. But with the right operating partner, that space can be very, very interesting. And it's not as competitive because people stay away from it for a lot of reasons.
Yeah, makes sense. So let's talk about your deal structure a little bit. It sounds like you are partnering with other sponsors on the operations side. And I'm also curious, are you syndicating or doing joint ventures, or how does the equity portion look in you know, most of your deals?
Sure. So we've done a variety of structures because, you know, our goal as a firm is to scale. And so what that means is to be flexible with structure to create something that's as advantageous for our investor base as financially possible and viable. And the reason for that, for those that are operators, is you have to make that decision clear. Is your goal to make a lot of money from a few deals, or is your goal to create a very large portfolio and deliver outsized returns to your investors? Those are two different strategies. Both are reasonable, but it's just important to understand. The reason I say that is that, you know, we have been on the side of, can we keep the lights on until the assets are actually taken full cycle? And that's something that I'm a big proponent of. Our firm, ASM Capital, basically acts as a investor relations arm of institutional quality partners that we have vetted and developed relationships with over the years. So a typical deal that we may find is, let's say there's a very large senior living operator who has $100 million of assets under management. That's not very large, by the way, but in the space that we like to play, that would be a large player because we like the firms that in that space is interesting. We can, without going on a tangent, that would be a great operator for us in that space. They don't want to deal with hundreds of investors. That's what I love to do. You know, in the beginning of the interview, I mentioned to talk about your strengths. That's what I like to do. That's not what they want to do. And so we will create an investing entity, invest into a deal, and get favorable terms for investing significantly, or we can act as a placement agent as well. I am a registered agent with the Series 22, and so I can direct capital to another company and basically just say, hey, here's the money, pay me a fee.
Mm-hmm. Great, great. And what's kind of your average investor size? It sounds like you're dealing with a lot of investors. It's not like, you know, three investors and it's done. It sounds like you're managing a lot of relationships.
Correct. Big proponent of that. You know, I've talked to a lot of people that are in the family office space and have a lot of respect. How can you deny someone that has a billionaire client? It's just really compelling. It's very interesting and it sounds great on resume. But from my perspective, lifestyle design is just so important to me. And the predictability of outcome is just so critical. And plus, I like to help people that are maybe similar to me just have a different career. So it is just lend itself to get a lot of checks over the course of a year as opposed to one large check at the end of the year. It's very hard to imagine a situation where we would do a tremendous amount of mutual due diligence. And then at the end of that phase, someone doesn't write us a $20 million check. And I know a lot of people that are in that space that have gone through that, and it's hunting elephants, right? So it's just where we decided to position ourselves in the space.
Yeah, that makes sense. Could you talk a little bit about your book, Raising Capital for Real Estate, how that came to be and kind of like who it's targeted for?
Yeah. So I wrote the book. Oh my gosh, it's almost been a year now. And it's been one of the coolest projects I've ever worked on. And not because of just how it's helped my business for sure, but I created a little Easter egg in there that said, look, if you're committed to doing this, I want you to send me an email tell me why it's important to you. And I did this as kind of a lead capture mechanism. So if people buy the book on Amazon, I don't get access to their emails, but I want to grow my base. And it ended up being just a coolest thing to see every single day, to get multiple emails about, oh, I want to send my kids to college. Oh, I really want to direct my own future. Oh, I have a background as this, but I sold my company. Now I can take this $5 million and turn it into this. And it's just like constantly motivation. And anyway, so that's been cool. But why I wrote the book is simple. I feel morally obligated to help people avoid what I was going through when I saw what happened in the European debt crisis. This is something that I take very seriously. The financial component was important for sure, but the emotional component of not knowing what was going to happen with my entire portfolio is something that I don't want people to go through, and I don't think they have to if they take a little bit more control. And so this book is the vehicle to help people get their friends, loved ones, potential clients to communicate this is the way, and to build a platform to attract capital. I specifically mentioned that because I failed miserably in my first capital raise. And I was able to present in a room with $30 million worth of net worth, 30 people, all of which were accredited investors, had a very compelling investment thesis and a pitch that I would give today with the same amount of confidence, and raised a grand total of $0. And I went in thinking, oh, I understand the business. I've created a track record. I have an institutional quality sponsor that I'm partnered with. This is going to be a no-brainer. And what really happened was, it takes more than 30 minutes to convince a room full of non-real estate investors that not only should they take your money out of the S&P, they should put it in real estate, and not only real estate, the mobile home park business of all things. Now, your listeners probably say, the mobile home park business, well, it makes sense. It's recession resistant. You're not building any more mobile homes, blah, blah, blah. That was news to this group, right? And that industry itself has changed drastically in the last 10 years, the popularization of that. So it takes more than a 30-minute luncheon to create a pseudo-religious experience for your investors. And so the book is about how to create a platform that allows you to do that in a scalable, replicatable manner so that, again, investors chase you around.
Sure, sure. Is there one or two things you would recommend for someone just getting started trying to raise capital for their first deal? Maybe they have some experience with their own capital, they have experience on the operations side, but are making that transition to bring investors on board with their projects. Is there one or two things that everyone should be aware of, or common mistakes that you see?
Yeah, so I'll say this. The thing that most people want is time and money. And for other people, the order of operations between which one is more important is different. And in your career, that balance can shift. But I have not found anything nearly as quality in terms of both of those as finding and identifying a thought leader that you really see eye to eye to, and you have a really good gut feel about, and investing in some sort of paid program of theirs. And, you know, we have one with CFCmentorshipprogram.com. You can check it out. But before you do that, before you invest in anyone's program, there's so much free content out there that you should devour that person's free content. Like, listen to 20 hours of our podcast. You'll know more about me than some of my best friends on this particular topic. And only then should you make an investment in our program or anyone's program. So that's one thing. It's all about surrounding yourself with people that are going to help you move your career forward, because the rate at which you compound your own growth is similar to the rate that compound interest works. So you can compound at 4% trying to figure out on your own and spend hundreds of thousands of dollars legal fees, which I have done. Or you can leverage someone else's playbook and compound at 33% and double your business every 3 years or more quickly. So that'd be my suggestion. But don't do it unless you've completely exhausted the free content and you start to feel like you're hitting a ceiling.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that makes sense. I highly recommend people do that and check out the podcast. It sounds like you have a conference coming up too, right? In January?
Yeah, I appreciate you allowing me to mention that. So we have an annual conference, which is really focused on the syndicated approach to investing with a focus on the passive approach. So what that means is that we found that there isn't really a lot of passive focused investment conferences out there. And if you take the passive approach really, really seriously, it starts to become very helpful for active owners, because they know what the most sophisticated passive investors are looking for and can then please them, and they can therefore please everyone. So if you're interested in looking at that, Intelligent Investors, or I should say IIREC2021.com, and it's in January. And I'm very excited about it. There's going to be billions of dollars of information represented there from people that control, you know, billions of dollars of real estate.
It's that time of the show for a segment called Best Deal, Worst Deal, where we talk about real estate transactions that you've done in the past so that others can learn from your knowledge and expertise. So Hunter, with that said, what's the best real estate deal that you've done?
The best real estate deal that I've done, again, looking at things on a risk-adjusted basis, I did invest in a self-storage facility that was a very solid, stabilized deal with some potential for additional revenue streams. And I'll get to the punchline. It basically generated a 28% net to investors return, which is a complete total home run. So it was purchased in about 2013 and sold in, I guess, 2017, which is, I mean, we doubled our money in 3 years. It's completely insane. On that risk basis, it's just ridiculous. The reason I like it, though, is that the real returns were generated. Yes, cap rate compression played a huge role, but the way that you can just turn on an infrastructure and immediately generate hundreds of thousands, if not millions of dollars of value. As an example, truck rental companies buying a property that has no truck rental component and then just adding that component with no income expense, no payment out of pocket, but just calling your contact at U-Haul, allowing them to park 50 trucks in your facility and getting $3,500 a month directly to the bottom line. That is an excellent way to generate hundreds of thousands of millions of dollars of value.
Awesome. What advice would you give to someone looking to do a deal like that? How did you find it? How did you create that value? Is there any advice you would give to someone who would love to do a deal similar to yours?
Well, self-storage in particular is very much operated like a business instead of a commercial real estate asset. It can be very complicated. And when people hear that, if you're in the industry, there's many people that say, no, it's so simple because all you do is you have these products, no one even comes to the property. I get it, but that's what creates the opportunity for value creation. There's a lot of people that get into the industry thinking, wow, this is simple. It's a no-brainer. Well, it can be, or you can do mandatory tenant insurance. You can do frequent rental increases. You can do outreach to universities and military bases, trying to do all these other things to add value that your competitors likely aren't doing. So in order to do that though, I really like finding a quality partner that's done it to the tune of 15 times and therefore has a huge advantage over a mom and pop owner.
Yeah, love that. That's great advice. And what would you say is the worst real estate deal that you've done?
So though it wasn't done through ASIM Capital, we kind of created a test fund for non-performing notes. And this was like a very small group of investors. And I drastically underestimated the amount of work that would go into servicing those notes. We had a third-party servicer, but you're basically, imagine buying 50 houses where none of the tenants are paying rent and thinking that a property management company is going to like solve that problem. It's very, very burdensome. It's a full-time job. And it made me realize how much dedication and intuition and systems and processes and relationships and software that would be needed to run that business efficiently. So we've done a lot of research on this topic and we didn't have it at the time. We didn't know it was required, but we resolved the problem and had to come out of pocket to make investors whole, which is a story that, trust me, it was a nightmare to live through, but it feels good to be able to say that, you know, that we were able to financially do that. And though it was a very much a headache, the fact that the investors know that that was something that we were willing to do for them, it means a lot, right? So that's the worst deal I've ever done, but it's not anything against the non-performing note space. It's good it was a test fund, right? And that's a big lesson as well. It was something that was manageable because it was just a few investors.
What did you learn from that going forward, though? Would you do that type of deal again? Or is there anything that you learned from that experience that you're now taking with you as you move forward?
Well, that was getting out of my box of where my expertise is. You know, we were the operator in that sense in a very nickel and dime type of business. From a personality standpoint, I want all of our clients to be people that willingly signed up to work with me. And that business is not like that, right? You're buying a IOU from someone that stopped paying. So it just didn't suit my personality. And it sucks to have to go and foreclose on somebody, not to take their house actually, because it's not really viable to do that, but to actually just to put pressure on someone like that. It's just not the way the business that I want to participate in. Not that I have anything against it at all. It's just I love getting out of the morning, being able to do podcasts and talk to investors and conduct due diligence on those more equity-based investments. So that's what I focus my time on.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Well, Hunter, thank you so much for being here. We're a little bit short on time, but I'd love to ask just one final question. Earlier in the interview, you mentioned lifestyle design, and I'm very curious if you can speak to that and how this industry has helped you with lifestyle design, whether it's, you know, on the active raising money side or even for passive investors. Could you speak to that a little bit?
Well, I think that a lot of people get into the industry of real estate because of the ability to take a week off or a month off and go to Mexico. And I did too. And I still am in it too. But you'll find that those that are successful, they're not in Mexico. They're not taking time off. They're grinding. And that's fine. But it's just important to kind of realize that if you are in this industry because it's an easy way out, it's not the right industry. You have to be an expert. You're competing against Carl Icahn and Warren Buffett and all these guys that there's a reason it attracts them. It's because it's very lucrative. And while real estate has created more millionaires than any other investment or asset class, it's also created more bankruptcies. So you have to respect what will go into the dedication it takes, especially if you're raising money from other people. So in terms of lifestyle design, I'm very much inclined to have a very lean and mean team. We have a team that has always worked remote all over the country. And I like that. At a home office right now, you can't see, but it's very beautiful outside. And it's allowed me to do that. But the allure of knowing I can take a month off and go to Mexico, it is true, but I just don't because I love what I do and my investors deserve my attention.
Awesome. And Hunter, where can others go to learn more about what you're up to?
They can go to asymcapital.com. And I also mentioned, the book. So we're giving away the first 5,000 copies. I think we've given 2,500 away. So it's raisingcapitalforrealestate.com. And I'm probably going to have a free training on there as well. So if you go there, once you buy the book, you should instantly get access to something that I'm super, super proud of. I'm not going to say the details of it, but it's there. So anyway, there you go.
Sweet. That sounds amazing. Well, thanks again for being here. I appreciate you taking the time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Cool. Thanks a lot.
Hey, everybody. It's Mark Allen Kenny. If you're interested in apartment building investments, schedule a call with me so we can have a chance to chat. My company is focused on growing your family's wealth with apartment building investments. So let's hop on a quick call and talk about your investment goals and see if we're a good fit. Find out more at stellarinvestmentgroup.com.